When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Well, hi there. I'm Nurse Mo, and this is the Straight A Nursing Podcast, where I teach concepts and share tips on how to thrive in nursing school and at the bedside. Thank you so much for joining me here today. We're going to be diving into a topic that is very closely tied to patient safety, and I know you care very, very much about that. Before we hop into it, though, let's take a quick minute for a listener shout out. And this one goes out to Maggie. And Maggie says this: I've been listening to the Straight A Nursing Podcast since I started my prereqs, through the entirety of my ABSN program, and as I was prepping for the NCLEX. I'm so excited to share I passed in 75 questions. I started using Study Sesh in my final semester, and it's incredible. I love that the Straight A Nursing Podcast provides clear and concise overviews and explanations, and the Study Sesh pod quizzes are an awesome way to practice applying what I know. I think I got through all the episodes. I'm unbelievably grateful for you. Well, Maggie, I am unbelievably grateful for you as well, and appreciate that you took the time to share your experience with the podcast and Study Sesh. Congratulations on passing your NCLEX and getting your license, and I have loved being your study buddy and hope that we're still study buddies today. Okay, so let's dive into today's topic. Like I said, very, very closely related to patient safety, and that is this concept of dysphagia. So dysphagia is a condition in which the individual has difficulty swallowing. And the reason this is so closely related to patient safety is because we obviously have issues with the airway if swallowing is impaired. So proper swallowing relies on this really complex coordination involving more than 30 nerves and muscles that all have to kind of work together and work flawlessly. When even one of these elements fails to work properly, dysphagia can result. So now let's just give a brief overview of the stages of swallowing so you can get a feel for what it entails. So there are 4 stages of swallowing, and the first is the oral preparatory stage. And in this stage, we're chewing our food, we're mixing it with saliva. I know that sounds really delicious, doesn't it? And this forms what's called a bolus. So that's that first stage. The second stage is the oral propulsion stage. And in this stage, the tongue pushes the food into the throat, kind of pushes it back, and swallowing is initiated. And then the third stage is really, really critical. This is the pharyngeal stage. And in this stage, it occurs really, really fast. It occurs in about 1 second. So it relies on the fast action and supreme coordination of the muscles and nerves involved. It begins with the initiation of the swallow, which moves the bolus through the pharynx and into the esophagus by way of peristaltic contraction. And at this stage, the vocal folds close to prevent food or liquid from entering the lungs. So that's a key component. And this stage ends when the bolus passes through the upper esophageal sphincter. And this whole stage is non-voluntary. It happens reflexively. You don't think about it. You initiate the swallow, and then all these other things happen. And then stage 4 is the esophageal stage. In this stage, the bolus is transported through the esophagus by peristalsis, and ends once it passes through the lower esophageal sphincter and enters the stomach. So you thought swallowing was just as simple as, well, I just swallow and it happens. There's actually 4 stages, lots of muscles, lots of nerves involved working very, very closely together to make sure this happens safely. So what causes dysphagia? So dysphagia is one of those things that can occur for a lot of different reasons. And these are going to be functional or structural abnormalities at any stage in that swallowing process. So conditions that put a patient at risk for dysphagia or cause dysphagia include, first and foremost, any condition that affects the neurological system, such as stroke. That's a big one in the in-hospital setting. Multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's disease, head injury, ALS or amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, cerebral palsy, and even dementia can affect the patient's ability to swallow safely. Also, any condition that affects muscle function, such as myasthenia gravis, muscular dystrophy, and esophageal spasms. There could also be structural abnormalities like cleft lip and palate in those little babies and esophageal atresia. It could also be from a complication related to acid reflux or GERD, such as peptic or esophageal strictures and esophagitis. Patients with cancers of the mouth, neck, or esophagus could have dysphagia. So could a patient who's had radiation to the thorax, the head, or the neck. And then certain autoimmune conditions, such as Sjogren's disease and scleroderma, would cause dysphagia or put a patient at risk for dysphagia. And then medications. Medications that reduce awareness or cause sedation, such as opioids, benzodiazepines, anti-seizure medications, and muscle relaxants could all cause a patient to be unable to swallow effectively during that period of time that they're affected by this medication. And then let's not forget topical medications such as lidocaine, which is used to suppress the gag reflex in patients undergoing bronchoscopy or upper endoscopy. So as you can see, it's not just your stroke patient who is at risk for swallowing difficulty. There are a lot of reasons why a patient could have dysphagia or trouble swallowing. So it's really important that you understand what signs and symptoms you're watching for so that you can intervene very quickly. And that's because dysphagia can cause some serious complications. So a key sign that someone may have trouble swallowing is the presence of dysarthria or that slurred speech. Again, that often occurs after a stroke. So you've got a patient who has slurred speech. You're definitely going to avoid giving them anything by mouth until you verify that it is safe to do so by that speech language pathologist. In fact, even without dysarthria, a lot of facilities may have a protocol where any stroke patient is kept NPO until cleared by the speech-language pathologist. And that's simply because the risk for aspiration is so high and the complications are so serious. Now, some other signs and symptoms associated with dysphagia include a hoarse voice or drooling. If the patient's drooling, they're possibly drooling because they're unable to swallow those oral secretions. If they're coughing with swallowing food or liquid, maybe you give them a sip of water and they're coughing, and they do that every time you give them a sip of water. I'd be highly suspicious this patient has dysphagia. If the patient complains of pain with swallowing or a feeling of fullness in their throat after swallowing, obviously choking when eating or drinking, and regurgitation. And note that the regurgitation could also be through the nasal cavity. Now, in some cases, the patient may not show outward signs of difficulty swallowing, yet show signs of aspiration, such as frequent lung infections, decreased oxygen saturation levels, tachypnea, or an abnormal chest X-ray. When this occurs, it's called a silent aspiration. So I've mentioned a few times that the complications of dysphagia are very serious, and the most significant complications of dysphagia are aspiration and choking. So aspiration leads to a particular type of pneumonia in your patients called aspiration pneumonia. And aspiration pneumonia can be very, very serious. especially if the substance aspirated is gastric contents. It's very, very acidic and it does a lot of damage to the lungs. We don't want any patient aspirating anything, getting any aspiration pneumonia. We definitely don't want them getting aspiration pneumonia from gastric contents. That is, in a lot of cases, a trip to the ICU and some time on a ventilator. Choking is, of course, another significant complication that is immediately life-threatening and requires emergent treatment. Of course, you're going to do that to clear the airway. And then other complications include things like malnourishment, weight loss, even dehydration, and electrolyte imbalance if the patient just isn't taking in any intake at all. So let's pause here, take a little quick break, and then when we come back, we'll talk about bedside swallow evaluations for dysphagia, diagnostic tests utilized, the different diet textures, and safe feeding and aspiration prevention.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for the New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
So now it's time to dive into bedside swallow evaluations. So there are two types of bedside swallow evaluations used for patients with dysphagia or at risk for suspected dysphagia. And one of those is a screening tool. And this is very commonly going to be the Barnes Jewish Hospital Stroke Dysphagia Screen. And this is a validated tool that takes the nurse step by step through a screening process that helps identify patients at risk for dysphagia. Basically, patients that need that deeper evaluation from a speech language pathologist. So this screening tool asks the nurse to determine, first of all, what's the Glasgow Coma Scale score? We want it to be over 12. And then the other question it asks is to look at the face, the tongue, and the palate to assess for asymmetry or weakness. And if the Glasgow score is above 12 and there's no asymmetry or no weakness in those important structures, then the nurse administers 3 ounces of water and observes for signs of coughing, clearing of the throat, or a change in vocal quality. And if any of these signs are present, it indicates the patient needs referral to a speech language pathologist for further evaluation. Now, again, in some facilities, they may keep all stroke patients NPO and they may all automatically see a speech language pathologist. And in some facilities, this screening tool is not just used for stroke patients, it's used for any patient who may be at risk for difficulty swallowing. So now let's talk a little bit about the speech language pathologist evaluation. This is more detailed and more extensive than that bedside nurse screening. It involves interviewing the patient about possible signs of aspiration or any associated medical conditions that would put them at risk for dysphagia. The therapist inspects the mouth and the muscles of swallowing to check for symmetry, strength, coordination, and range of motion. Next, the speech language pathologist provides the patient with water and a variety of foods of different textures for them to try. This could include things like applesauce and pudding and soft solids like peaches, and then things that are a little less soft like crackers, for example. Throughout the evaluation, the therapist is observing the patient's swallowing ability. They're looking for food that remains in the mouth after swallowing, and of course, for any signs of distress. The therapist then writes their recommendation for the patient's specific diet texture, which we'll talk about more in just a moment. But first, let's talk a little bit about some diagnostic tests utilized in dysphagia. So in addition to that speech-language pathologist evaluation, other tests may be utilized for the diagnosis or evaluation of a patient with dysphagia. And one of those that's pretty common is the barium swallow test. In this test, the patient drinks a barium solution that is visible on X-ray, so the process of swallowing can be evaluated very, very clearly. This is especially useful in cases of silent aspiration because we can see that liquid and see exactly that it's going in the wrong places, it's going into the airway and into the lungs. There's also fiber optic endoscopic evaluation of swallowing, or FEES. In this test, a small camera is inserted through the nose to visualize the larynx and the esophagus as the patient swallows foods and liquids that contain a visible dye. The patient may get an upper endoscopy. So using a scope inserted through the mouth into the esophagus, the gastroenterologist can identify structural abnormalities that contribute to dysphagia, such as esophageal strictures or tumors. And then another test that could be conducted is esophageal manometry. And for this test, a tube is inserted through the nose into the stomach and connected to a device that measures esophageal contractions as fluid is swallowed. Now let's talk a little bit about those diet textures that I mentioned a moment ago. So depending on the individual's swallowing ability, the speech-language pathologist will write a recommendation for a specific texture or level of diet. Note that there doesn't tend to be universal exact terminology for what these levels are called and how they're categorized. Like level one at one facility might be level five at another. They may flip them the other way, but you get the idea. So let's first talk about pureed foods. So for your patient with dysphagia who is able to have something beyond just thick liquids, they could possibly have pureed items. And all foods, of course, are pureed, and they're pureed down to a pudding-like consistency, including their meats and all their vegetables and even their dessert. So examples of foods would include applesauce, cream of wheat, mashed potatoes, and pudding, and of course, pureed chicken or pureed steak. And at the facility where I work, they try to make it palatable. They kind of put it into a little shape, like the corn will be put into a mold so it looks kind of like a corn on the cob, and it's really kind of cute, but it's still pureed foods. I would say of all the textures, this one is probably the one that patients have the hardest time with. I mean, I would too. So hopefully anyone on pureed foods graduates at least up to minced foods, which would be the next level up. So in addition to being minced, which means cut up very small, foods are also soft in texture and moist, so they're easy to swallow. Examples might include minced chicken with a gravy, so it's got that moistening component to it. Oatmeal would be considered a minced food, and then of course, minced vegetables. And the next could be bite-sized foods. Foods in this category are cut a bit larger, but are still soft and easy to eat. Examples include scrambled eggs, fruit cocktail, and macaroni. And then there's the soft or easy chew level. This texture consists of foods that are simply easy to chew, such as pastas, eggs, well-cooked vegetables, and tender meats. They're not necessarily cut into a specific size. Now, in addition to the foods, the speech-language pathologist will also determine if patients need to have their liquids thickened, as thicker liquids are easier to swallow than regular liquids, which we also call thin liquids. So if the speech-language pathologist says, oh, Bob's fine with thin liquids, that means Bob can have straight water, straight coffee, straight juice. You don't have to add anything to it to thicken it. And liquids are thickened with a special thickening agent that will come up with their food tray, and the consistency of how thick the liquid needs to be made will depend on the patient's needs and determined by the speech-language pathologist. So, for example, some patients will need very thick liquids, so their juice or milk or whatever that comes with their tray will also come with two thickening packets that you add to the liquid in order to thicken it. I've never tried thickened liquids. I'm honestly a little nervous to try thickened liquids because it just looks so strange. But if you get the opportunity to try thickened liquids, give it a shot so that you know what your patients are experiencing. All right, to wrap up, let's talk quickly through some safe feeding and aspiration prevention guidelines, because again, dysphagia is all about patient safety. So first and foremost, you need to know which patients are at risk for difficulty swallowing and aspiration. It's not just going to be your stroke patients. It might be your patient that is on a PCA after their back surgery. So their level of consciousness, they might be a little bit drowsy. That patient is at risk for aspiration and difficulty swallowing. So know which patients are at risk. And ensure suction is functional, available at all times. I hope that you're doing this as part of your room safety check when you go in first thing in the morning or at the very start of your shift. You're also going to use that suction equipment as needed to clear the oral pharynx. You want to maintain head of bed at 30 degrees. And for a patient who's at high risk for aspiration, we're keeping them at 30 degrees all the time. For example, this is your patient who's maybe not able to really handle their oral secretions that great, or a patient with a nasogastric tube having enteral feedings. You're going to keep head of bed at 30 degrees. And then when we're eating our lunch, we're going to position the patient in high Fowler's, or better yet, get them up to the chair for their meal, for eating and drinking. And then they should remain upright for 30 to 60 minutes after eating. You want to encourage the patient to eat slowly and to chew each bite thoroughly before swallowing. And this is a little easier to do if you're actually feeding them. You can control the pace. But if you're not feeding the patient, they're able to feed themselves, encourage Bob to eat slowly, chew everything, swallow, and then move on to the next bite. You want to also remove all distractions and allow the patient to 100% focus on the process of eating safely. Now, the speech-language pathologist will have guidelines for the patient, for feeding the patient. So in my facility, these are posted at the head of the bed. So make sure you check those before you initiate feeding the patient. And this can include things like this patient pockets food on the left cheek. So you want to know that information so you can periodically or after every bite, check the left cheek and say, Bob, you've got a little food there. I want you to swallow what's in your mouth. And if you can't get it, I'll suction it out. Okay. You don't want any food left behind for aspiration. And then you want to monitor for signs of aspiration or swallowing difficulty throughout this whole process. That's going to include things like coughing or drooling or clearing the throat a lot or respiratory distress. Hopefully we don't get to that point, but yes, it could happen. If any signs are noted, you're going to stop the meal and notify the physician and the speech-language pathologist. And of course, if your patient's choking, you're going to rescue them immediately. And then you want to ensure medications are safe to swallow. This could be, in some cases, simply putting the tablet or the capsule in pudding or applesauce makes it easier for the patient to swallow it. Some pills will need to be crushed. Remember, not all pills can be crushed. Not all capsules can be opened. So make sure you follow those guidelines very, very carefully. And in other cases, maybe you just need to advocate for a different formulation, such as a liquid formulation. And then also at the end of the meal, perform oral care for your patient or encourage them to do it if they're able to do it themselves. You don't want any little bits of food remaining in the oral cavity that they could potentially aspirate later on. So there you have it, your overview of dysphagia and how you awesome nurse, are going to keep your patients safe. I hope you found this helpful and informative and something that you can apply to your practice right away. And I also hope to see you back here next week, where we're going to dive into something that you see a lot in the clinical setting, and that is C. diff infection. So I'll see you back here next week for that. Bye for now. This podcast is brought to you by Straight A Nursing, a proud member of the Airwave Media Network. For more educational podcasts, check out airwavemedia.com. And for more nursing-related content, go to straightanursingstudent.com.
At a time when change is constant and we are pulled in far too many directions, we need a way to stay present to life and to increase our ability to remain calm, think clearly, and maintain our well-being. Many studies indicate mindfulness improves our mental, emotional, and physical health. On A Mindful Moment with Teresa McKee, you can learn how to practice mindfulness and enjoy its many benefits. Tune in for guided meditations and to hear tips and advice from some of the most respected experts in the fields of mental health and mindfulness. The world truly can be a better place. It all starts with a mindful moment.